This is Mae Brussel. It is tape number 862, June the 13th, 1988. There was a small article in the Houston Post titled Dallas Museum Plan Upsets the Kennedy Clan. This was June the 1st, 1988. It comes out of Quincy, Massachusetts. Members of the Kennedy family are upset with Dallas officials' plans to make a museum out of the building used as an assassination perch in the killing of President John Kennedy. Friends who didn't want to be identified said that the family is really dismayed. It's such a poor idea. I don't believe they even want to discuss it, but they're very upset by the fact that the Historical Society in Dallas is going to make a special site for the place where John Kennedy was murdered. What is of interest to me in this story is that the Kennedy family reacts to hardly anything. I should say nothing. The only thing that Jacqueline Kennedy objected to, at least that we read about, was the book of William Manchester, The Death of a President, and there was a lawsuit to delete sections out of that book. Other than that, the accumulated family members, and I read off the names of Bobby Kennedy's family last week, have said nothing so far and about any of the information or evidence that has come out about the plans to kill John Kennedy that were set long time ago by the Daltex building location for rifle shots, the grassy knoll, that location, the CIA Bay of Pigs persons that worked not only with the assassination teams, but one of them in particular was in Dallas that day. Frank Sturgis admits he was there. Nothing has outraged them, but now the museum is going to be officially dedicated, I'm sure, November 22nd, 1988, on the 25th anniversary of the murder of John Kennedy. After 25 years, they don't like the idea of the museum. Well, the museum has been planned for years, and I've had it on different broadcasts earlier. I don't know how they're catching on at this point, that it's offensive, but at least maybe somebody's catching on. The London Sunday Times, May 29th, 1988, had a small article which caught my eye because I didn't know why it was appropriate, except as the anniversary of Kennedy's death appears, and it's sort of like a mind control or mind slot, giving a person an idea, a spot coverage of a news story that maybe you pick up. It has to do with the murder of John Kennedy, and the question was asked, where were you when John Kennedy was killed? John McEwen was a policeman on the beat at Newbury. This is in England. Someone said they heard on the radio that John Kennedy was killed, and so when I saw two tall Texan United States airmen from Greenham comment, I asked if it was true. They said yes, and they smiled. I realized they were pleased at the news. I still remember with disbelief, should remember that in Texas, in the schools, children cheered at the news. I don't know how he saw two tall men and knew they were Texans, but that's the story that's just recently, two weeks ago, in the London Times, and I don't know for what reason that was printed at this time, except maybe to pass the message, the subtle subliminal message, you don't have to be sad about it. A lot of people were glad that he was killed. That's the way I interpret these little spot things that are non sequitur, and reaffirm the belief of a lot of people that Kennedy should be wiped out. And so he's talking about the school children's reaction to the death, and also airmen from the United States service in the service in Great Britain. Last week I talked about Gorby Dahl and a section of an article, just a quotation from an article whereby he said that there are two governments, that the secret government, the National Security Council government, and then the Congress and the elections are the showpiece, that these two separate branches exist, if you say exist, side by side. Actually, the Congress and the electoral process was taken over by the National Security Government. Just as I began my article, my first published article, there are two governments side by side, one visible and the other invisible. But that was the Watergate story in 1972. And certainly the National Security Council has had more visibility since then. To continue with the Gorby Dahl story, he has an article in Nation. It was published June 4th, 1988. The National Security State, How to Take Back Our Country. I'm not going to give you his suggestions because I don't agree that these are the ways to take it back. But he goes into the fact that the American Empire started officially in 1898 when we took over the Philippines and came to a peak in the year 1945 when we decided, when the war was over, that we would control the countries that we had conquered, Germany, Italy, Japan. We'd take over their economies, their political lives, and that we, the United States, would begin with full military bases. We would take over the private sector and be on a standby, a continuing plan, as referred to by Charles E. Wilson, a businessman, and it refers to a quotation in 1944, a full preparedness and a continuing plan. And then this article goes on to say how Harry Truman escalated the Cold War and decided that every country that was on the border of Russia was to be followed by the American police system, and that there's no country too remote to serve as a scene of contest that may widen until it becomes a world war. And this is, in fact, what is happening. What is a national security state? Gore Vidal asks. Because in order to continue to keep military control of our former enemies and then our allies and all the neutral countries, it would take a national security state. He said it began with the National Security Act in 1947. It was implemented in January 1950 when the National Security Council provided a blueprint for a new kind of country. And this is, of course, the thing that I've been harping upon for years. Unlike anything the United States has ever known, a document called NSC-68 that was only declassified in 1975 commits us to the following. First, never negotiate ever with Russia. Two, develop the hydrogen bomb, so when the Russians get the atomic bomb, we'll be one step ahead. Three, build up your conventional forces. Four, put a large increase in taxes to pay for all of this. That's what our national debt is all about right now. Five, mobilize the entire society of America to the terrible specter of communism. And this is where Senator Joe McCarthy comes in. And before he began this mobilization and the red attack and the smears and so forth, he went to Dachau prison and released Fritz Kramer. This is what Vidal doesn't put in as a solution. He doesn't even mention that. Six, set up a strong alliance system that became NATO. Seven, make the people of Russia feel that they're our allies. It's just the communist system that's wrong. And the CIA will be doing, of course, the active participation. We have our Radio Free America and United States Information Agency and the various radio broadcasts. David Emery has a series of tape broadcasts called Radio Free America, and I'm so used to using that name that the air station used by our country is not Radio Free America. But that was a slip there because the real title should be Radio Free America. Our radio for propaganda is not for a free America. Then his article goes on to the fact that Harry Truman was used for a series of speeches starting in October of 1947, as soon as the CIA was formed, about the Red Menace, that France was in danger, Italy was in danger. And of course, keep in mind that Klaus Barbie and the fascists were running Italy right after the war and have consistently been part of attempted coups along with the help of our government. And Tom Clark, the attorney general for Harry Truman, published a list of dissident organizations in December of 1947. So the climate of fear was maintained by the Truman successors. And Gore Vidal refers to this as the cynicism of the coup d'etat. He calls the National Security State and the National Security Act of 1947 as being a coup d'etat. I always refer to the shots that went out in Dallas as being the coup d'etat in America because that ended the electoral process as of 1960, where there were free elections, and since then they've been run with blackmail and bullets and now with computer manipulations that I'll do more on next week. But this was a coup d'etat because America was really taken over and all parts of our government were geared towards the anti-Russian World War III thinking, and our economy is geared towards that. And he refers to the fact that they literally hijacked the country established military conscription in peacetime, overthrew governments that do not please them, and keep the rich very happy, and the poor pay mostly through taxes and our national debt for this terrible thing that happened. And yes, indeed, it happened, and I don't think it was a coincidence. This was all planned, and I've mentioned many times the meetings with Reinhard Gehlen's agents and SS Karl Wolf and Heinrich Himmler's persons with William Donovan of the OSS and Reinhard Gehlen, who flew to this country and set up the NSC and the CIA, identical to the secret government that was put into power after the Versailles Treaty until Hitler could be in full regalia by 1933. I've mentioned before the book Secret Warriors. It just came out by Stephen Emerson. I haven't read it. I've read parts of it. But there was just recently in the Miami Herald a review of this book called Exploring the Cancerous Cells of Secrecy. And the problem is that the investigators who are doing the exploring are private, we used to call them muckrakers, private investigators, private authors. Steve Emerson is doing what the Tower Commission should have done, except they appointed people like General Scowcroft, who was a national security advisor and on the board of Kissinger Associates, and so forth. So the NSC should have been destroyed at the time of Watergate and not after Watergate, certainly the Iran-Contra affair. And, of course, this book goes into the fact that where secrecy and democracy conflict, secrecy dominates and it warps democratic ideals, and that our secret missions and our special armies, like the Special Operations Division, and, of course, the Green Berets and the Rangers and the SEALs, etc., are the private armies that are really going to bring us fascism in this country. And now Gorby Dole is speaking up about it, which I wish he had done years ago, as early as I caught on to the National Security Council, because a lot of people attack the CIA, Philip Agee, John Stockwell, and I could list 30 or 40 books where the CIA is the whipping boy. It is the National Security Act. I said it before and may be saying it every single week until I discontinue this series, because that is where the problem is and has been, bringing Nazis to the country and forming the National Security Act and really taking over this country. It was a coup d'etat in 1943, starting in Bern, Switzerland, and it finalized, of course, in Dallas, where the election process was over. Now, speaking of election process, I can't fail but mention that Eugene McCarthy, again, wants to run for president. What does it mean? He's not going to win. He unsuccessfully ran three times, but he has a press conference. He has a party that he calls the Consumer Party from Philadelphia in 1967. But all Eugene McCarthy does is go around splitting votes and taking, not from the Republicans, from the Democrats only. And it is really a tragedy. Jim Garrison, not the attorney in New Orleans, but the Jim Garrison out here in California, who was one of the founders of Christic Institute with Danny Sheehan, ran for office. His primary campaign was in the Palo Alto, Silicon Valley area. He didn't get enough to make any dent to become a member of Congress. He may someday. But coming out to help him raise money for this event was Eugene McCarthy, and that made me very concerned and suspicious about the fact that this fellow comes into our area, because he goes wherever he can go, I suppose, because his sole role has been to split the Democratic Party, not to combine it so that we get, or they get, the maximum amount of votes. If you look at the book, maybe you don't have it, they're hard to get. The book is called Who's Who in the CIA. It was published in 1968. I've had this and shared this before with you. There's Eugene Joseph McCarthy, born March 29, 1916, a teacher, professor of economics at St. John's University, and he was in the War Department in 1944, a member of Congress, 81st, 85th Congress, a senator from Minnesota, worked for NATO, and he has been a member of the CIA. His operational base, according to this book, and this came out a long time ago, of course, 20 years ago, but he hasn't been anything but divisive for 20 years. His base is in Washington, D.C., and he was the one who had all the counterculture putting daisies on their Volkswagens and thinking that that little peaceful group could stop the war in Vietnam. He didn't stop the war in Vietnam, and Henry Kissinger and it was Richard Nixon who used it for, again, for electoral purposes and had it timed for their his re-election in 72 and in 1968. All you had to do was to kill Robert Kennedy and have the big riots in Chicago and pay off Hubert Humphrey, and Richard Nixon was back in the saddle where he wanted to be in 1960 when he lost to John Kennedy. There was a meeting of the platform committee, people making the platform at Mackinac Island this weekend, and there was a story from the Washington Post about the meeting that would be held, about the platform committee would have Representative William Gray from Pennsylvania heading the committee, and then for help they would go to Theodore Sorensen, always described as a speech writer for John Kennedy, but never cared a bean for who killed John Kennedy, another one of those silent friends. But Sorensen is a person who I've described in other broadcasts, particularly when Gary Hart wanted to run for president, because Sorensen was a person promoting Gary Hart, again, a very divisive kind of an operation. I never trusted Hart, and Sorensen is very, very close to Henry Kissinger, and he also wrote a book on the electoral process. He's the man, one of the many men who wants to do away with Senate, that the senators would be appointed, a president would be 6 terms only, and we'd have elder statesmen in the Senate like Zbigniew Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford and Richard Nixon. And he has written a very, I think it's a terrible book on destroying the American Constitution. And he, again, like Senator Joe McCarthy, in my mind, has been a detriment to the Democratic Party, if there is a Democratic Party. I don't want to make too many comments on George Bush more right now. I'll do more later. I suppose you saw the stories or watched Nightline with George Bush. Ted Koppel, anchorman, was talking to him, and 3 different times George Bush was calling him Dan Rather. I'm wondering if we have another mind-controlled president. He said, he apologized later. He said to Koppel, "I apologize for calling you Dan. I wasn't being smart. I can't see you. I'm in Houston, Texas." Well, you know, Ted Koppel has had Nightline on for, I guess, 10 years or whatever, and there hasn't been a guest who didn't know who they were talking to. There hasn't been a person who didn't know they're talking to Ted Koppel, and many of them aren't sitting in the same room with Ted Koppel, and this was just outrageous that he kept confusing him with Dan Rather, and I wonder, as I say, if there's another mind-control zombie here who doesn't watch any of these programs, doesn't know any of these people. This is a man who was our CIA director and who wants to be president of the United States. The Miami Herald had a story May 29th, 1988, about Iranian influence that might meddle the U.S. presidential race, and now the tables are turned a little bit. It's by Richard Feen, F-E-E-N. It's titled, "GOP and the Democrats Must Stand Firm. They Expect the Iranians to Meddle in U.S. Presidential Race." Well, isn't that cute? I think that's just really righteous. The article says how they meddled with the hostage crisis in 1980 and held back the hostages, and that was the trouble that Jimmy Carter had with the hostage crisis, but not a paragraph about Ronald Reagan and the possibility that his team were having an exchange of arms to Iran for holding the hostages until Richard Allen became National Security Advisor, and Edwin Meese was in on that affair, and he became the Attorney General. I hate to say that because he may be out soon. The report's coming in on Meese. But the point is that this Richard Feen is saying we have to be very careful because the Mideast may influence our elections. Well, what if Khomeini decided to hold the hostages up till Dukakis was in? What if he was tired of Ronald Reagan's lies and his distortions, or the way he behaved after they helped hold the hostages back, and they don't like the way the Persian Gulf was mined, and so forth? Ayatollah Khomeini may be very angry at Ronald Reagan this time, and he's had 8 years of Reagan. So they may do something dramatic. We don't know. But this person who wrote the article was saying that both parties should stay away from the Iranians and be on the alert that they could use our elections for some meddling when they obviously were used by the Republican Party in 1980. And this isn't in the article. Also, in the same article coming out of Miami Herald, there's a subtitle called Bush Blames the Israelis. Now, part of this article says that George Bush believes that the Israelis were to blame for the Iran-Contra affair, and moreover, he has supported earlier Arab attempts to stabilize it and the oil prices. Well, Bush is an oil man. All of you know that, Zepeda Oil. And, of course, his interests are very closely aligned to oil platforms and Middle East or anywhere around the world that needs oil platforms. So George Bush, at this time in the Miami Herald, is coming out, which he did earlier, and blaming Israel for the Iran-Contra affair, which I think is very interesting. Now, there are a lot of earth-shaking articles, about 60 or 70 I wanted to put on this one tape and can't. But there is one that really blows my mind, and this is titled, Reagan Blames the 1960s for the Drug Problems. This came out of the San Francisco Chronicle, June the 10th, 1988. President Reagan said yesterday that America's problem with drug use in the workplace stems in part from the students in the 1960s and 70s who experimented with illegal substances and retained their destructive drug habits. In many ways, our country is still paying for the erosion of our values and the decline in self-responsibility that occurred in the 60s and 70s, Reagan said in a speech to corporate leaders trying to drive drugs from the workplace. Now, Reagan was the governor in California from 1968 to 1974. He had a continuing attack against people who protested the war, who were working for the farm workers, for the Venceremos, for various political organizations. He hated them all. He hated the musicians and marijuana around turned people on, the lifestyles of the people was totally offensive to Ronald Reagan and the people around him, like Edwin Meese and the group that went to Washington with him. And there was an ongoing battle continuously, which I summarized in the book, not the book, the article, the SLA is the CIA. And to blame the youth people and the people, students of the 60s and 70s for the destructive habits is horrendous. Now, there's so many books out on drugs and the United States government's involvement. One of the most recent is Acid Dreams by Martin Lee and Bruce Schlein, published in 1985. And it tells you about the CIA and LSD and the 60s rebellion. And, of course, the laboratories of I.G. Farben, the same laboratories that made poison gas at Auschwitz with their Sandoz labs and with Mr. Hoffman, made approximately 34 million LSD that Alan Dulles brought to the United States. And, of course, they distributed them all around the youth people, the protesters, the students, and we handed them out like candy. And, of course, these suckers fell for it. They shouldn't have. But the CIA was handing what you call illegal drugs if it came from the government. How do you define that? And, of course, I was mentioning last week and have continuously talked about the role of Lucky Luciano and how Frank Sinatra, one of Reagan's closest friends, was with Luciana in 1947 in Italy and also in Cuba. And this was the hub of the drug network that was to pour into this country after World War II with Meyer Lansky and offshore islands. And the drug connections are so horrendous. What we're paying now is a penalty of releasing Lucky Luciana and putting him in Navy intelligence and putting Santos Trafficante and John Rosselli and Sam Giancana into the CIA. The book Stefano Della Calle goes into the connections of drug and violence and terror. And, of course, one of the best books on the involvement of our country in bringing in drugs is The Great Heroin Coup, written by Heinrich Krüger in 1980. And if I wanted to spend the rest of this tape, I could cite page after page of the use of the mafia. And even Great Heroin Coup goes into a member of Gerald Ford's National Security Council working with mafia dealers, New York mafia families, and the use of mafia working all the way up to the NSC, which is identical to Donald Gregg at working in the NSC with George Bush, dealing with Gomez Rodriguez. Medellin Rodriguez has fingered him with $10 million of narcotics money. And the gall or the chutzpah of Reagan, going back to the 60s and 70s, is horrendous. A good friend in the Bay Area who sends me my articles from Italy that I have often on the air that he translates sent me one article that was just published a year ago that epitomizes what Ronald Reagan is covering up, what this country is covering up, the fascist elements of the National Security Council, the drug running, the CIA, the links to Klaus Barbie, and I want to share this article with you to counter this ridiculous BS that Reagan puts out about the 60s and 70s and the morals going down at that time. This article is published from Grandma out of Havana, Cuba, June the 21st, 1987. It's from Buenos Aires, and it goes this way. The arrest in São Paulo, Brazil, of Argentine terrorist Alfredo Mario Mingola in a drug cleanup operation is expected to lead to more information in the connection between the United States Central Intelligence Agency and the Worldwide Drug Network. And remember, George Bush was director of the CIA at the hub of a lot of these activities that I'm going into. The article says that Mingola was arrested as part of an anti-drug division by the São Paulo Federal Police, and he's involved with an operation in Bolivia. His close ties are to Captain Flores of Bolivia, an army officer. The special division investigating drug traffic in Argentina worked with the São Paulo police. Formerly a Catholic priest, Mingola lived in Bolivia between 1980 and 83, and Reagan was in office from elected in 81 to 83. Mingola there worked as an expert in political repression, sent there by the Argentine army, and at the time the Argentine army had him there, they were training the Contras with Ali North and our National Security Council down in Nicaragua up until the times of the Falklands War. The article says he worked as an expert, political repression. He worked under Colonel Luis Arce Gomez. This is a close friend of the Republican Party, of course, and he helped with those people who had toppled the constitutional regime of Lydia Guler. Mingolas has been mentioned by former Bolivian Minister of the Interior, Gustavo Sanchez, as a collaborator of Nazi Klaus Barbie. And, of course, Mr. Gomez Rodriguez, George Bush's friend and co-worker, worked with Klaus Barbie in the murder of Che Guevara. So the Bush connections, of course, go down to these roots also in the Reagan administration. Mingola carried out his intelligence work for the Bolivian army while he did drug traffic operations with Mr. Gomez. One of Gomez's henchmen, Italian Emilio Carboni Basigalupo, bought an estate in Bolivia where he would be growing coca with Mr. Mingola. Mingola helped start the activities of Reverend Moon's organization, CAUSA. And not only was Reverend Moon put together by Mr. Ryosha Sasakawa, Japanese mafia, but the Italian Argentine fascists had a hand in forming CAUSA. That's the Anti-Communist Confederation of American Societies. Of course, CAUSA is big in Central America. It's an international organization set up by the Moon sect, and Mingola was instrumental to set that up. And of course, I've mentioned on other tapes the fact that Mr. Bohai Pak worked with Klaus Barbie and with Mr. Gomez and the drug dealers down there. So this close group, they're very close to each other, and they tie into drug traffic, assassination squads, death squads, and of course, always the anti-communists. This article says that Mingola worked for military intelligence of Honduras. He worked in Guatemala and also in Panama between 1976 and 1980. George Bush was CIA director in 1976. When arrested in La Paz, he said he took his special training at the School of the Americas in Panama to wage against the anti-communist struggle. He hadn't been a military man, but the Argentine military intelligence legalized his military status. All he had to do was be a paid killer. Mr. Mingola is close to Stefano Della Calle, founder of the fascist group. It's the three A's, the Avanguardia Nazionale, and is the stories of Stefano Dallachè I've had on other tapes. Also, his links to Prince Borghese, who was part of setting up Permadex, that was responsible for the murder of John Kennedy. This tape side is just about out, so we're going to take a 30-second break, turn it over, and I'll continue with Mr. Mengola, a typical comrade of Ronald Reagan and George Bush, the real drug connections, not the 60s and the 70s.